Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we've got our intro music kind of going overtime today. Just bear with me, it should shut off here shortly. That's a live show. Anyway, our guest this evening is Glenn Steckling. He's assumed the responsibility of his family's work in the field of UFO and ET research. Since his father, Fred Steckling, passed away in 1991. Glenn is the head of the George Adamski Foundation, and his website is located at www.adamskifoundation.com. He's an airline pilot, an expert on the George Adamski contacts. He's an excellent public speaker, and it's always great to have him on the show. Glenn, how are you this evening?
Good evening, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
I am going to start out here, and I want to bring up something you may be familiar with. Dr. Herman Oberth stated in a public meeting that we cannot take credit for our record advancements in certain scientific fields alone. We have been helped by the people of other worlds. And Dr. Oberth made that statement in 1972. And this is one of the only scientists that I can think of that has publicly stated that there has been extraterrestrial contact here on Earth. I'm sure you remember that statement, and I'd like to hear you comment on it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. He made that statement. Other public officials and scientists have talked about it a bit as well. As you may remember, both Tesla and Marconi claimed that they had received radio signals from Mars. Other scientists have said that we had help from above. And so, you know, another one stated that you cannot attribute it all the scientific development that we have occurred in the last 100 years purely to our own escalation of scientific thinking. When you think about it, it took us, you know, thousands of years to go just from horse and buggy stage to the turn of the century. So there's quite a few people that have said a few things, and they've accumulated over time, and so I think that we can take some solace from the so-called academic society and groupings that have come out, some of them, like Marie Chatelain and others who have spoken about their very real documentation of UFOs and extraterrestrial contact.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Marie Chatelain? I've heard you talk about him before.
Right. He wrote a book called Our Ancestors Came from Outer Space. And he held the patents and the development of a lot of the Apollo telecommunication systems. And in his book, he recorded and chronicalized that every single space mission that we have gone on, from Mercury all the way through the Apollos, all of them were accompanied by UFOs, extraterrestrial spacecraft. Sometimes music was even piped into the Apollo spacecraft. Our own astronauts were listening to them.
Wow.
And so he was very forthcoming with that. And if you do a little bit of research back into the 60s and 70s, you can come up with other documentation, which I carry also in my lecture briefcase. The Gemini astronauts talked about it, and many others have. As you well know, Gordon Cooper, Brian O'Leary, Edgar Mitchell, who recently passed away, and so on and so forth. So there was enough, shall we say, accredited, which everybody seems to be wanting to hear, you know, who's got a name, who's got a title that can give us verification, you know, that there is something to believe in. So there's been enough of them, there's no doubt about it.
Music, you said music from E.T. Craft was somehow piped into the astronauts' spacecraft?
That's correct, yeah, broadcast in. And so not any different than you can broadcast our own radio and television waves, we broadcast to them as well. And so the music is described very much like classical music, like Mozart and Schubert, very harmonic and melodious, things like that. So it's very much a more, shall we say, civilized type of music that we're accustomed to these days.
Isn't that kind of interesting? Almost strange that they would decide to do that.
Well, not really. When you think about it, we've done a large number of experiments ourselves with different types of music. If you recall the oceanographer from the 50s, Hans Haas, who was actually a little prior to Cousteau's launching in the South Pacific, he spent a lot of time broadcasting different variations of music and underwater speakers to the fish and the sharks and what have you, and noted the type of reaction. So when they played classical music, there was a very harmonious swimming around and curiosity, and when the music changed to something more modern, then everything got a little bit more erratic. It's based on frequency, and frequency affects us as well as all the rest of the natural world as well.
It's interesting that they didn't try to pipe in any kind of, you know, language. And, you know, you'd think they would maybe say, hello, we are such and such from a certain star system. It's interesting to me that they didn't choose to do that. Instead, they would just kind of send in some music to kind of,
well,
I don't know, to
let's
relax.
Look at this from the actual standpoint. First of all, they're flying alongside and accompanying the craft to and from or around the orbit of the Earth or to and from the Moon, so there's really no necessity to say hello. You just can look out the window. And secondly, all the astronauts had already been briefed on the existence of ET spacecraft and extraterrestrial human visitors, so this was not a big surprise that we kind of think it was or assume it was. So everything was thoroughly briefed. There was already a great deal of familiarity between, and so consequently it was, a semi-normal type of activity, so to speak. Well, we're on the outside left guessing. They were not guessing. They were well informed.
Oh, okay. Do you think we might have even known who the people were that were following us, where they were from, or anything like that?
Well, absolutely. As I had stated in previous show with you here in 67, when my father and mother, Mrs. Rutherford, went before the 22 scientists at NASA Goddard that Dr. Lohmann put together, the discussion was that the scientists were well aware already of how these spacecraft work, the electromagnetic free energy, the time of human occupants, from which planets they came from in our system. This was not information that was astonishing to them. They were already, like I said, well briefed. So 67 was now into the Gemini program, and we know that, of course, earlier briefings were already taken care of. Mr. Adamski briefed President Eisenhower, in fact, took him to an airbase and introduced them to him, and he did it as well for President Kennedy. That was his two government contacts.
You know, it's also interesting that Dr. Oberth said that they had contact with people of other worlds, not insectoids or reptoids or any kind of strange creatures like that.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, when you go back records historically wise, wherever there's interaction, not just in the last century, but back from millennium, as far as, look at Ezekiel's 1-15. They talk about the likeness of human beings. And so this was not by any stretch of the imagination a strange notion. We have been bombarded so much with science fiction to trying to replace science fact. And of course, we have a contingent in this field itself that wishes to ignore the basic biochemical laws that exist on this planet and also in space, which seeds all of the life on all this planet and everywhere else. The organic chemistry, the basic elements, atomic structures are all the same. So if you talk to anybody that is in the biochemical field or astrochemical field, like, for instance, the late Dr. Panampura, who wrote The Principles of Life and described how the molecules align and which combine and which don't. For instance, silicone will not combine to produce anything solid because it's water-soluble, and water is the most common element in space and on the planets. So we have this total science fantasy and complete ignorance about just the basic principles on the construct of life. And from that ignorance, we then try to propose our own ideas. It's sort of like the Kennedy assassination. We're going to just assume a single lone gunman, and we'll make all the evidence fit to that and ignore everything else. And we are quite practiced at doing just that. So we'd like to assume that the certain conditions exist on other worlds, and therefore then we're going to try to twist and turn to make our theories concur with that possible environment where we are already erroneous from the very beginning.
I don't know if you've heard of William Tompkins, I believe his name is. He's a 95-year-old man. I believe he worked at TRW as well as a few other companies. And he's been doing a lot of talking about what our governments knew about certain extraterrestrials and what kind of contact that was had, and what kind of technologies we might have been working on. Have you heard of him at all yet, Glenn?
Yeah, I've heard the name, and of course I'm familiar with the concept since we have had these crafts, just to take it in the last 200 years, if you look back, a number of these sightings and records put together quite an astonishing amount. So when we look at the total sum of these reports and the recovery of some technology from some downed crafts and insights that were very close and similar scientifically to their method of propulsion and free energy, it's not a far stretch to know that we tried to mime and replicate. The Germans tried to mime and replicate what they saw in their skies, and they came up with some crude facsimiles like the Hanabu and other different types of crafts, the Messerschmitt version and what have you, but that had nothing to do with the ones that were already photographed already far back as 1918 over Europe, long before the Nazis came into power and did any type of experimental development. So when you look at the actual history, the foundation of things, you find that we have been visited. These crafts have been depicted, in fact, in some of the medieval paintings and records that go back in the sky. And so it is all we're trying to do is try to play catch-up. And in a way, that's how we advance, because when we notice something, we think, well, heck, they did it, why can't we? How do we go about replicating it? And that's the beginning of the baby steps towards the continuance of our scientific development. What is the old saying? When you mime somebody else, you give them the greatest compliment there is, because you're trying to attain the same thing that they have over time.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Oberth even stated that he had studied the performance of UFOs. So really, he had no questions that they existed. He also stated that today we cannot produce machines that fly the same as these UFOs do. And he stated that these UFOs were flying by means of artificial gravity. Do you think that now that we have produced machines that are flying by artificial gravity?
Well, we call it progravity or progravitic. We have, once again, the science fiction terms of antimatter, anti-gravity, anti-everything, which was implicate the fact that we would try to overcome the immense forces of nature to try to fight against it and counter it, when all you have to do is merge with it, and then you become the beneficiary of unlimited energy. And so we have things a little bit backwards. But from the pro-gravity standpoint, yes, the craft uses the same principle as the planetary bodies use. It produces its own gravity. It surrounds itself in an ionized field, and within that field it is capable of maneuvering at immense speeds and directional changes because it is not using the principles of aerodynamics. We are locked in our thinking that anything that goes into the air must function under the principles of aerodynamics, where you must have an airfoil, it has to be a certain shape, it has to be accelerated, you have to create high and low pressure above and below in order to get this thing to fly and overcome our so-called weight versus gravity issues. Well, the planet itself is showing you that it's quite capable of doing that, producing these forces as well. So when you merge with the principles, as George described in the last book that we just put out, Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery 2, then you get yourself into becoming the beneficiary of all the energy that is produced, the hundreds of billions of trillions of watts of electricity that basically your planet as a Van de Graaff generator produces and throws out lines of magnetic force into space. And if you travel on those magnetic lines of force, which travel at twice the speed of light, you're looking at basically 360,000 miles per second. And when you look at the distance from the Earth to the Moon, about 249,000 miles, well, you're looking at that, and that's about, you know, about 6/10 of a second as far as their travel capabilities are. So, you know, there, once again, the scientific fact versus our theological fiction is quite different.
Can you tell us more about your new book?
Sure. Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery 2 is basically, the first book was published as Flying Saucers Farewell by George Adamski in 1961. And it listed his experience on the world tours and many different sightings they had and interactions with people like Queen Juliana and Lord Dowden, Lord Mountbatten, people like that around the world, some of them which were her sponsors. And when it was republished in the early 70s, it was republished under the new title in paperback, Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery, and we chose to continue that title and simply add the two to it because we composed about 55 pages of evidence and current scientific realities that backed up what George had to say and basically give people some true information versus the hypocrisy of the innuendo and opinions that have been slung around about George from people who didn't know what the heck they were talking about. So we provided that in a very clear and concise reference section of where that material came from so other people can go and look for it for themselves. It's not invented. And then for the first time in this book, and then from the original even, it didn't have pictures, we included 22 pages, photos, illustrations, some of them out of our archives that had not been seen before, and letters and correspondence between people like Major Kehoe and Frank Edwards and others, and give people a view of exactly some of the things that transpired there. And I think that the with the new chapter and with the very nice graphics and pictures that are in there now, people start to get a little bit more clear picture of the fact of who and what George Adamski was versus the demagoguery that loves to be constantly repeated from people that just collect it from others.
Why do you think George Adamski has been so attacked?
Well, it's very simple. In fact, I'm not the only one to make this statement. One reporter made the statement, and he said it's quite apparent that the UFO community would love to shuffle Adamski underneath the rug. They love to use his pictures. In fact, a couple years ago when I watched the so-called Disclosure Project, they showed pictures during the hearings and identified everyone who had taken those pictures until they came to George Adamski's pictures, I think, which they showed too, and they didn't mention him at all. And it's quite a simple fact that with his pictures, they're indisputable, have been analyzed and over again, and the negatives are available, and so on and so forth, and the films, that nobody wants to dispute his evidence because, as you can see by some of the pictures I've supplied you, it is concrete. What they're having heartburn with is the fact that he stated he had contact with human beings, which is, first of all, the hard thing we have because we're so used to Star Wars and the bar scene, which we have to have 50 billion different variations of creatures to satiate our our fantasies and our concepts that we have grown to misunderstand. So the human being aspect was, although not hard during those times, it becomes harder and harder as we continue to go forward, because that's the tangent that this whole field has been taken in order to confuse it and misinform it. And then the other half of that is, of course, to state that the human beings are coming from planets in the solar system, because we have become accustomed to accepting a single or binary source of space information that is easily filtered in order to give us information which is carefully chosen selection versus which we would get our own hands on. So while you ask the people, do you believe, and I often do this during lectures and symposiums which I have the privilege to address people at, I said, well, I note that there's a hint of skepticism from people. Do they believe their government or military and so on and so forth? And they all say no. But yet at the same token, they're willing to accept space information that comes to them from that very same source and that very same singular filtered source as well. And if we look at it logically, we have to understand that we have developed a line on which we were going to deny that these craft came to visit us. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of reportings, tens of thousands of photographs of motion picture coverage from 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And even up till today, I've seen some very good footage from China. I know Russia has a great deal of activity and so on and so forth. So we were going to deny that. But then when we go into space, we certainly can't say, well, we went into space and found life, because people are going to say, well, hell, then you lied to us quite explicitly, because if there's life out there, it's coming to visit us. So two lies have to support each other. So we have used the space program to push everything to distant reaches, to other solar systems, other galaxies, and so on and so forth, so that it's so far away that it gives the psychological disconnect that people think, well, you know, that's so far away. What's the likelihood of us ever getting there or them getting here and so on and so forth? So it's a very calculated and very fail-safe method of redirecting this entire issue.
Do you think we might have another contactee like George?
There's a number of contactees that happened during that time. While George was the most supported, I would say, because his contacts were continuous, they often traveled with him, had the privilege to meet several of his contacts. He was usually always in the company of them, because in order to go out in this field and to address this issue, you have to have an immense support structure, because the stress, the ridicule, the attacks that come from both without this, from within this community and from without at that time were immense. You still had the Men in Black, you still had intelligence communities and CIA and FBI harassment and so on and so forth. Now not so much anymore, because they could care less. But when that shifted in the early 60s, the UFO community itself became the next witch's brew of misinformation. And so as that continued to develop, that became more and more tough. And I recall that there were two sisters that had contacted Norway, another woman in South Africa. There was a fellow in Italy. If you look and do a little bit of serious research, it's not too difficult to find. But in George's case, he was pretty much selected as one of their foremost representatives. And they supported him thus and helped open avenues of contact throughout the world in order to get that message across. And as I've mentioned earlier, by delivering a sealed message to Pope John the 23rd about a week before he passed away, giving the Vatican a certain amount of information, which means by no means that they're the only theological institution that received it. It's just he carried around that little gold medal that was awarded to him because of that service. So there is no division. There is no opinionation. Among these space people, they come and give the information freely and equally and do not live a divided life, and certainly do not promote that amongst us as well. In fact, they try to teach us exactly the opposite. So George was very well supported, and didn't mean it wasn't tough, but when you have friends like he had, you're a lucky person.
What are your thoughts on Howard Menger as a contactee?
Well, I think it's important that people do not look at things based upon my particular viewpoint or assumption or collection of information. I think each one of these people have to stand upon their own accord, have to take a look at the information and the evidence that is presented by each one of the individuals who chooses to come forward, and then based upon some common logic, rationality, a little science, a little intuition and feeling, I think that people should be able to ascertain for themselves exactly what they find believable and what not. The only thing that I can give people a little bit of hint on, when you look at the saucer-type craft, the bell-shaped craft, you will notice that authentic pictures have a set of portholes that contain four portholes together. And we have several little models that were cast in copper that were given to us as part of being a co-worker for George. And these models purposely had only three portholes in them so that nobody would ever acquire them and try to mistake them for the real thing or try to substitute for the real thing. So I've had a number of people around the world ask for pictures from our archives showing those four sets of portholes, and there's some others around the world as well. So I think that when, once again, you have a little bit of information that gives you the ability to have some critical thinking, not necessarily skeptical, because that leads to a negative state of mind, but critical thinking is very important.
I've always kind of enjoyed listening to Howard Menger tell about his experiences. I know he talked about meeting with Venusians, and he also, I remember in one contact, he was saying that he met people that had come into this cabin in the woods and somewhere near High Bridge, New Jersey, I think, and they were playing these instruments, and they taught him somehow to completely play by ear. And from that moment forward in his life, I think he had perfect pitch and he could play almost anything by ear. But he always came across to me as a very believable kind of guy, I guess I could say, for lack of a better word. He also talked about trips to the moon as well. And did Adamski get any trips off the Earth?
Oh, he yes. Did. George describes his trips around the moon already in 1955 with the book Inside the Spaceships.
Right, I got that.
Right. Okay. He described going in orbit around the moon, noticing the fact that there are some areas where the atmosphere is more concentrated than others, especially on the backside of the moon, which is not so affected by the Earth's gravitational pull. The elongation upon the moon is very dramatic on the front side, so things are a little bit more hostile there. The backside's a little bit more, shall we say, balanced. And so when you go into the deep craters and deep ravines, just like on this planet, atmospheric pressure condenses and compresses as it goes deeper. So if you're going into the Grand Canyon or Dead Sea, Death Valley, anything going below sea level, you start to find a compressibility effect going on. And that's the same thing anywhere and on the moon as well. And so what light atmosphere is available there and atmospheric pressures, it becomes more compressible the deeper you go. And then you add to the fact that we have proven already since 1971, the Apollo instrumentations, water geysers spraying for 14 hours and so on and so forth, that that the moon has water, has ice, has light atmosphere, can be compressed. So you start adding together all these elements, and George described those. He described areas where there are, you know, lights and devices moving along the surface. There's some areas that are have been covered by magnetic shield, and so the atmosphere is compressed in it, very much like in a football stadium, only you can see through the top. Depending on certain angles, it will reflect and look opaque, or you can see into it and you can see what's inside. But he described some vegetation and some animal life and things like that, whether that had been indigenous to the moon over time or whether it had been transported by those who are using it as a base, that's really irrelevant. But he made these descriptions along with the firefly effect that Glenn described in 63 outside his capsule. And so all of this in combination we have substantiated and repeated inside the new book so that people are reminded that what George spoke of has come to fruition and continues to do so. In fact, it was pointed out to me by one of our coworkers that when we announced that there was salt water on Mars, he went back and looked at George's 1963 printing of the Science of Life study course, and he mentions in one of the lessons that Mars has an abundance of salt water. So I think that that as far as George is concerned, he has been spot on for decades. This, of course, annoys his skeptics and others who dislike him to no end. But to answer also your previous question, we have been in the development and replication of these type of propulsion systems and crafts. They look a little different. We have appendages and things like that, which is not conducive to long-range space travel under these propulsion methods. It is basically appendages tear off at high speeds, no matter how you envelop it in the system. But we have replicated some of this type of technology and been able to use it to go back and forth to the moon outside the official public space program that we are promoting up front.
Do you see the backside of the moon as kind of a place where there could be more than one ET base?
In the pictures that I sent you, there's, I don't know if you put it up there, there's one 1930s large telescope, one of our major telescopes, photograph of Gassendi Major. Gassendi crater's on the front side of the moon. There's Major and Minor. Major is a much larger one. You'll see a whole series of tubular constructs running along the crater, not only 90-degree angles, U-turns, punching through the crater walls, continuing out the other side, so on and so forth. So the astronomers and many other people have noticed, both professional and amateur, that there's a construct going on the front side of the moon. Now, since the development of our laser programs, microwave beam accelerators and things like that, and even at one point we were insane enough to want to detonate a nuclear device on the moon. That never came to fruition, thank God. But we are bombarding the front side of the moon with a lot of our research and development technology. And so to a certain degree, it is a much more safer environment to move around to the backside. Now, I believe here, and I think many others do as well, that we have our own installations on the front side of the moon, and there's still some installations from other civilizations as well. But to a great degree, the backside's a little bit easier for them to work with.
So do you think it's possible we could be being watched by more than one race and that they have a base on the backside of our own moon?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I would use race as the word. I would say that there are a number of, shall we say, I'm trying to think of a good word for it, a number of representations of intelligent life that have traveled through space, and the moon is a great observation post. In fact, Dr. Carl Sagan made that statement already in the 60s, that if he was going to establish a place to watch what was going on planet Earth, the moon would be the prime location. So I don't think that that's a very difficult stretch. I think from the NASA photographs that I've also sent you there in the upload from our earlier book, Alien Bases on the Moon 2, which contain about 100 NASA photos directly from their archives, which we already collected first generation in the 70s, that book came out in 81 and I updated in 97, you'll see that there's what looks like mining activity, tracks moving along the surface with some kind of vehicle parked in front of them, areas of clouds and mists. And if you look at the chronological listing from NASA in 66, which I carry in my briefcase as well, it also lists half a dozen pages of these same types of observations over the last 150 years. So from the standpoint of resources, raw materials, helium-3, all kinds of things, it's a very advantageous place to conduct activities.
That's amazing. You know, I've often wondered why we didn't go back, or why we haven't been back more often. What are your thoughts on that whole scenario?
Well, I think to some extent we've been mesmerized by the fact that we haven't gone back officially. That doesn't mean that we haven't gone back. Right? There has been some talk over the years that we had established equatorial launching locations around the planet that were conducive to launch vehicles into space so they would reach aperture before they reached any civilized areas or observation. And then, of course, if you're going to step away from, let's say, the Saturn V type of launch vehicle and go into something that's been developed electromagnetically, then you don't have to worry about that visibility and you can go up into the atmosphere and out into space at a will. And there's been talk about that since the originating points of the magnetic poles, electromagnetic lanes, that there's some shifting up towards the Arctic regions and Antarctic regions before they accelerate into space. So the book Alternative 3, which came out as a documentary in England and was slapped down very quickly and then quickly labeled fiction because the public started to become a little bit paranoid, very much like War of the Worlds, talked about our own communities that were going to the moon. And, of course, they were recruiting, shall we say, laborers in order to work in the construct of these developments and bases on the moon, and that was a one-way ticket. So it painted a very grim picture of people who were taken by our own people, nobody from extraterrestrial origin, where we would take our own people and recruit them very much like into slave labor. God knows we have a long history of that on this planet. And a one-way ticket to go work on our bases, and that's also some of the scientific families. There was the great brain drain of the late 60s in which certain scientists, their entire families disappeared.
Really?
So that was the implications of that particular publication, Alternative 3. It's very hard to find. You might find a few copies still out there. And the interesting thing is, to mention the moon, in 81, when we came out with Alien Bases on the Moon, I think there was only one book in front of us, Somebody Else's on the Moon by George Leonard. After us came Moongate by William Bryant III. And we basically launched the lunar anomaly investigation with these pictures, in which I still have the originals in our vault. And yet, whenever I watch a television program or documentary on television at night, which has to do with the moon or alien bases or what have you, they'll show pictures from that book, but they've cropped them out. They will never, ever once mention where those pictures came from or the author. And I've been told quite explicitly it is because of my father's association with Adamski.
Wow.
Which we really don't care. I mean, at one point, my father was offered by the intelligence community more than $1 million tax-free offshore account wherever he wanted it if he would refute George Adamski, and my father told him to kiss his behind. So so it goes to show you, and I mean, I could list the names, but I will be diplomatic and not say any of them, of all the people who have accumulated data based upon that book since, and there's a number of people in this field who go about and collect other people's work and then, shall we say, rearrange it a little bit, slap a title on it, and suddenly there they are with it. But in reality, you know, there it was, and I'm always amazed by the fact that they won't even acknowledge that publication exists.
You had sent me a photograph, and I don't know if it was in this recent batch or it was an older one, but it shows an astronaut on the moon, and there's a charge. Looks like a charged field around him. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, there's an Apollo picture of the first landing there in '69, in which you have a picture being taken of him. He stands there, and above him is an ellipse or lenticular shape of the craft, fully charged. Casting the bright white light down over the astronaut itself, so you can imagine that these two gentlemen were quite, shall we say, I don't know if you can say astounded, because of course they had been fully briefed and aware of it, but these craft made themselves available for seeing and for filming, with the hopes that we would not cut and filter the information that was very necessary for the development of the space program, development of the civilization, the acknowledgement of visitations, the need for cohesive interaction, and so forth. So truly the amount of evidence is overwhelming. I mean, any skeptic can come up with a million different phases of nonsense, but they can't offset the plethora of information that's there. But the Apollo shot, which is on the back cover of our book, Alien Bases on the Moon, we were the first to publish that, yes.
Armstrong had issues with mental illness in his later years. Do you think that may have been because of all the secrets he had to keep?
Well, we don't want to become like the rest of this society that loves to throw out innuendo and opinion that can't be substantiated. If astronaut Armstrong had become affected by what he saw, then I can only say that he was true to his beliefs, and he tried to do the very best he can with the conditions that were given to him. And so some have said that he became a little bit more vocal over time. The only thing I can say is that I've read that he came back a changed person. Mm-hmm. And I have read that the same from many of our space travelers, whether it was in Soyuz, Skylab, the space station, or the Apollo program. Some of them have come back highly impacted by what they saw, not from the fear or aggression standpoint, from the sheer magnanimity of it all, if that's the right word. The sheer thought, the sheer concept, the sheer realization of the truth, I would say, that has been quite inspiring to many of them.
You had also sent me a photograph of what I think is called the Greater Cassini Crater, and it looks
that's
like
the one I spoke about.
Is that the one with all the? Looks like you could see trails or something that has been moving.
Yeah, all the tubular constructions, the lines that are moving through there. Mm-hmm. There are going to be dozens and dozens of them. That is a middle to late 1930s professional photograph of that was printed. And we were the only ones who had that for a number of years until I released it, and then I've seen it replicated again. But that's a okay thing. I mean, the material needs to be out there. People need to see it. It doesn't matter who it comes from. As long as it is not misrepresented. So that's what I'm very careful to make sure, that things don't become easily misrepresented, because I've seen people running around with stuff that they claim they took that I can prove they never did. So.
Now, isn't also there are these tubular structures that were also photographed on Mars at one point?
Well, Schiaparelli and others, they talked about the constructs on Mars. And that was a little bit earlier, and the discussion goes both ways. They say now when you look, you don't see them, so they try to make them out as optical illusions based upon whatever story they wanted to come up with. But there's another side to that story, and the fact that these type of structures or canals, very much like what you would see in Cassini Crater, were running from the North Pole south, and as we know that there is water on Mars, underground water as well. And if you look in the California desert, you see the Colorado River Project, where you see open canals as well. But open canals have a 65% evaporation loss. So now we're talking about covering those canals as well, and the same speculation occurred on Mars, that the original construction of those canals was to bring water from the polar regions down to southern areas, and then with the high evaporation rate, they were eventually covered over in order to not have such a huge loss, because Mars, of course, doesn't have anywhere near the same type of abundance of water as we do. They have greater abundance underground. And so that has been one of the issues that people are talking about as well. So I personally feel that that's a greater likelihood, because we do not show. We always go to the most remote areas, the most remote regions. If you remember Viking in the 70s, it was scheduled to land in the plains of Cydonia, where the so-called face on Mars and the pyramids and structures exist. Mm-hmm. And once the photographs were analyzed prior to the landing by Petrie and Molinar, immediately Sagan ordered that the craft was taken off its landing trajectory and put in another place. It was totally and far remote. So, so Sagan? One has to wonder, of course, you know, the reasons for that. And secondly, Dr. Jastrow, who ran that program, came out, and I have that report, in which he says that we have found 100% evidence of microbial life on Mars, which, of course, was the beginning to add all to the development of life from there. And he said we just are not going to admit it because of the academic parameters and budget constraints, and these all have to do with those who hold the purse strings and what information they want out and what they don't. So we already had found evidence of the beginnings of life forms already there in the 70s. And the interesting thing is, of course, they ran tests in the Atacama Desert out, in, I believe, in 2003, and the same kind of instrumentation from Viking, and then the upgrade of which we were sending Mars Lander and the Atacama Desert, for those who don't know, in South America and Argentina is the most remote desert in the world. And our own instrumentation on our own vehicle said that based on the readings they took in that area, there's no life on this planet. So there's a whole bunch of discontinuities that give people a rise to question, and I believe it's if it's collected properly and presented properly, which we try very hard to do, it gives many the opportunity to think a little bit beyond what is being presented to them face-to-face.
Now, you mentioned Carl Sagan. Did Carl Sagan have some authority at NASA?
Oh, yeah, he was part of the program there, absolutely.
Oh, I didn't realize that now. So he redirected that craft away from the face on Mars and away from the Cydonia region?
From what I read, what's called a Mars Mystery, I believe it is, by Graham Hancock. He described some of that in there. That's what I had come across, that information, that there was a redirect of the landing zone once those pictures had become public. And, of course, Petrie and Molinar were the first ones, and then they were another group thereafter. And as I described in this new Behind the Flying Saucer mystery, my father was an Australian in the 80s, and he met the authors of the book called The Face on Mars. Hmm. And there was a description of there, because he was lecturing at the university, and he described the fact how difficult that book was to get published. Basically, not a publisher in the United States would touch it. One in Australia touched it for one publication and then refused to renew, so they said that there was a great deal of pressure on the authors and the books. I think it was Hertek. I can't remember him. I'm looking on my shelf to see if I can see where that book is and recall the...
J.J. Hertek?
I don't remember if it's Hertek, but I'll have to look and see here. But either way, it's the meeting. My father described the meeting with those authors then, and he said that according to the authors, not only did they have undeniable proof of past civilizations, but of current ones as well.
Current civilizations on Mars.
That was his statement.
That's a huge statement indeed.
Well, I mean, you know, once again, there are, have been others who have made similar associations with civilizations on other planets, and I think for most people, we have to understand that human life is incredibly adaptable, all life for that matter. And so if you go into the high Andes, you know, in Cusco's and the high silver mines at 14,000 feet, you've got people that are working up there. You and I would drop dead from the lack of being able to assimilate in that high-altitude terrain. And we have Sherpas in Nepal that will walk up 22, 25,000 feet without any oxygen bottles, and the rest of them are lugging around big bottles of oxygen because they can't handle it. So there's a certain great deal of adaptability. And so over time, I think that that's quite a deal possible. George also mentioned as well that when he traveled and had certain experiences, they took the amount of time to adjust the pressure so that when he arrived at his new destination, that he was body was properly acclimated. Not any different than you and I going on a skiing holiday. First couple of days we huff and puff. Third, fourth day we finally feel like we belong there. So, you know, there are very slight varying of conditions, but on a whole, you know, the standard parameters of comfort and susceptibility are pretty normal.
I've heard some people saying that Trump has talked about releasing technology that has been suppressed. Have you heard anything like that?
No, none of these people have the ability to do that. Mrs. Clinton alluded or insinuated to the same thing. Nobody since the time of Kennedy, he was the last president to actually have a somewhat full briefing, but no president since that time. In fact, Jimmy Carter tried, and then the CIA director, who happened to be Mr. Bush, said it's above your class, no, your security clearance. And President Clinton tried. Ronald Reagan had his own experiences as governor flying a Learjet in California, which he saw one of these craft. And but as far as we have this fallacy that the president is the know-all, tell-all, can do whatever he wants, can get whatever he wants, and that's nonsense. That has not been so for decades.
Do you think Bush Sr. was completely briefed?
No one's completely briefed. Because you have sort of like an onion, multiple layers. The deeper you go into the onion, the more obscure the identities of the individuals involved with the geopolitics and decision-making are. So you have the periphery, which is basically what we see as our government, which has little to nothing to say. Then you have those underneath them whom we have thrown out some names in the past, you know, the conspiracy people with certain names over the last several centuries. They themselves, since their names are known, are only the tokenary figures as well, because the real figures are not recognizable names, nor do they ever become revealed. That's not how that system works. So some people have varying degrees of information. Very few have a complete picture. George's last book, Is Space War Inevitable, that was never published, describes some of that and remains secure in our vault due to specific instruction.
Now, did you say space war inevitable?
That's correct.
And that was the name of a book that George wrote but wasn't released?
His last manuscript, correct.
And it was his choice not to release that?
No. It was his, in combination with his space contacts, that requested that manuscript stay in the vault.
Oh, really? Wow. Indefinitely.
They've informed us since that it hasn't changed. We follow our instructions.
Oh, is that right? Wow. I feel bad. I've put you on the spot so many times asking questions related
well,
to that.
Well, no, not at all. I'll answer what I know. I can't answer what I don't. And, of course, George had a great saying. He says, I've told you the truth. I just didn't tell you all of it. So So, you know, we all have a little bit of a filter, and that applies just the same here.
So they have recently told you this?
Well, within the span of since the time George passed away and now, yes.
Oh, okay. And how did they contact you?
By arrangement, appointment, just like anybody else.
Okay.
You know, there were times when the contacts that we knew from George would make arrangements or come to a certain place at a certain time in order to meet, and then certain things were discussed and certain venues and for a particular period of time, and off they went. So, you know, that's they got other things to do too, and we're not the only people on the planet that you know, had that privilege of communication with them. And still, on a whole, like I said before, when you have friends like them, you really consider yourself extremely fortunate.
Have they ever just appeared in your home?
No, they don't.
They don't do that.
They don't do things like that. First of all, they are so attuned to our ways of thinking, our mind, our habits. I mean, basically, we are a complete open book to them. They can read our thoughts. They know our history, so on and so forth. So they don't have to do magic. Play magical games in order to get your attention. They come and talk to you. Why wouldn't they? I mean, the best way to communicate with people is to do it face-to-face and to do it so that you understand. And God knows, even when you do that, how many times does a message get messed up here? I mean, you can hardly get any kind of an agreement or unification out of a small group of people, let alone a large one. So they are very aware at our own insecurities and frailties, and when they come to give you and work with you and talk to you, they do so in a way that you do not have to doubt what is happening.
Do you get a phone call or a telepathic message?
Well, I don't think AT&T connects from another world, but if they do, they get a better network than I do on my cell phone. But what they do is they are aware of your movements, and so they can place themselves at a specific place that you're going to be. For instance, if they want to get in contact with you, they may well know that, you know, at this particular place and time you're going to go and be in a certain city or be at a certain venue or what have you. So they're well aware of your schedule, so to speak, so they can place themselves in your proximity. On occasion, it's not been unknown to come to the front door, but that's extremely rare.
Wow, that would be. So it sounds like these meetings occur when you're out, you're doing something else, and then suddenly someone's there, and you know that this person isn't your average Earth human being, I guess.
These meetings occur usually when you are engaged in the work of this particular program. So your mind is already working with this. You're already dealing with it, preparing yourself, interacting with others. So you're already in that thought frame of thought. So, but you have to be careful. It doesn't mean anything is guaranteed. Because if you lose yourself in your own thinking and your own schedule, your own hectic activity, the bombardment of our own routines, then they're not going to come up to you like the Three Stooges and slap you upside the face and say, hey, listen, you have to have the avenues of communication open within yourself in order to start the initial process. Very much like, you know, you look at a crowd of people, you're not pretty sure how they're going to react, and God knows we're very unforgiving and very unpredictable. And so you do your introductions very thoroughly, very thoughtfully, to see if those who are aware or will pick it up and then respond to it. So the process is vetted very carefully. They watch you. They look at your state of mind. They look at how you react, what will be the consequences or possible consequences. They don't do things haphazardly, and neither do they wish to put you in danger as well, because that would be counterproductive, wouldn't it? So, you know, it's things are just not arbitrarily off the cuff and, you know, damn the torpedo, so to speak. We act like that because we don't care about the consequences. We believe the end justifies the means, but they sure don't act that way.
I think you mentioned on a previous show that you had seen an individual that you had met decades earlier and that this individual had not aged at all.
Yeah, significantly not. No, yes, this was what, maybe, let's see, 25 years later, something like that. And we've got to remember that we measure time like this beast that is constantly striking on the anvil. We live everything in the stress of time, and so it takes a huge wear and tear and toll on our bodies, our minds, everything. They don't live under the same constraints, so they have the opportunity to let their body function normally and live in an environment which is much more conducive to longevity. And when George made the statement that we're capable of living 200-300 years or more in our form, everybody laughed at him. But geneticists just about a year ago, and I saved the report, said that we have the capability here on this planet as well, from the genetic standpoint. The problem is we do not honor our own forms and what it needs and requirements, and so we do what we want versus what is necessary, and that has always gotten to us to a lot of trouble. And so to answer your question, yes, after a number of years, saw this individual again. And, you know, 25 years to us aging-wise may have been 5 for them.
Wow. Do you have a small group of these people that you meet with? On? Are you allowed to... I don't know if you can comment on that. It sounds like there may be more than one.
Of course. No, to answer your question is there's no specific group. There is no hierarchy. There is no a method of priority. No. When you recognize it, we have to remember that there are a number of them walking and working and living amongst us for a short period of time. And so... And they all portray the same level of care, the same level of education, ability, understanding. So it would be like living in a community where everybody helps and takes care of one another. You know, as a child, it didn't make a difference whether you was your parent, aunt, uncle, or the next door neighbor. Everyone looked out for the children and raised them and took care of them to discipline them in the same way, where we have this strange concept that, you know, it can only be done from us and what have you. Other ancient societies, you look at the ancient Hawaiian society, they lived exactly the same way. That the children needed to go live with a neighbor or whatever for a particular period of time, they did, and there was no big deal because, you know, they had this very much collective view of taking care of each other. And in the same respect, it doesn't make any difference whether you see the same individual again or you see somebody else. They consider themselves all brothers and sisters of both themselves and of us. It's a relationship that we could definitely foster.
Do you know the names of any of these people?
We don't go by names. No.
They don't? Do they don't even have names?
The individuals that I've come across, it was never necessary to, you know, say, hi, John. You just said hi. You know, the recognition comes from, you know, it's like if I hadn't seen you for a while, I walked up and I said, hi, how you been?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, hey, Mark, what's going on or whatever, you know, they said, we have so accustomed in this world of labeling things. we label each other. We can't have just one name. We got to have two or three, and then we got to label the animals and the plants and the species and everything else, which could care less of what we give them for a name. And so, in a way, it's just a further method of division. It's not necessary. The recognition is from person to person, not from a name to name, or more importantly, from language to language. That's not necessary either.
Well, that's very interesting that you say that, because I remember in some of George's books, he made the same point, that they didn't go by names.
Yeah, well, that's correct. The names that he gave them in the book were symbolic names. Each one of those names have a particular historical reference and reason here, but those were not the names of those individuals. He merely gave them names so that you would recognize them when you read it in the book.
Yeah, it's so interesting because we not only do we have two or three names, but we have a social security number and everything. I mean, our society would not work the way their society has to be completely different.
Well, we never get past a decent stage of progress in order to get further down the road. Our first problem is that we love to perpetuate ignorance. And if there's any greatest sin, I would say ignorance is the biggest one. Simply because we don't recognize who or what we are. We identify with something else. If you ask people, well, who are you? And they'll say, well, I'm Italian, I'm Spanish, I'm American, I'm this, I'm that. You're none of those things. Not one of them. Where you happen to have been born are obscure lines drawn on a map by somebody who can redraw them in the past or have redrawn them in the future. It means not a thing. And so we don't for a moment try to identify who we are. George wrote an article, Who Lives in This Shell of Clay? That's what it was. And basically, we have the outside body, but that's not who you are. That's what you have borrowed momentarily from the environment where you live in. And so we already start from a false premise. So thereby, once we understand a little bit who and more what we are, and on our construct, how we function, I mean, how many people spend any time at all, not a single thought, how their body works? There's an excellent book called The Body Electric that tells you how you are constructed. You're basically chemistry and electricity. But people prefer to remain ignorant. It's more important on who wears what at the inaugural and who does what to whom in the entertainment. They could care less about who and what they really are. And so if we choose to remain in that ignorance, then all we will do is perpetuate ignorance.
Well, Glenn, I've kept you late, and I appreciate you coming on. I want you to get a chance to talk about your website and any of your other books and anything else you want to leave with our listeners. That'd be great.
Absolutely. Well, as you mentioned earlier, Mark, AdamskiFoundation.com. We also have a Facebook page. It's George. Then the second word is Adamski Foundation, one word, and we have quite a number of people from all over the world, different walks of life and thinking, who participate in that, not necessarily in what we are engaged in always, but sort of it's a forum for people to communicate. It works out rather nicely. The books I mentioned are available either directly from us. You can get them on ABE.com, Amazon, eBay. I think the latest book is quite revealing. So far I've had a great deal of positive feedback on that. And I will be in Laughlin, Nevada for the conference that's by Paola Harris out there in November, and also one in Europe in June. And I encourage everybody to take a look at the material. There's some very good material available. And also to keep in mind that this field, this whole subject of space, is basically where we need to go as far as our technology, our industries, our method of preserving the planet. We need to rapidly make some very concise choices. The planet is changing geophysically, both itself and also some of the tipping points on which we're doing it to it. Overpopulation is probably our greatest threat, indiscriminate overpopulation, which is just abundant no matter where in the world I go. I see it just escalating unbelievably. So,
Glenn, let me throw something in quickly. I know we're running out of time. Have you seen the YouTube videos of the 50 lanes of traffic near Beijing going in one direction?
I've been in Beijing. I've been in China. I've seen it there. India, South America, due to religion and many other stupid politics and also self-anointment and greed and ego, we continue to destroy our world, and we do so through overpopulation, the greatest threat, far surpassing nuclear, and I think biological is the next problem.
Indeed. I you know, they have traffic jams that go on for hundreds of miles. They last for days.
Well, that's true, but we continue to perpetuate a consumerism that means that, you know, we can only have prosperity if we sell certain things, the byproducts of which can be very detrimental to our health, planet's health. We don't wish to make the next step because we're too busy exploiting the current one. But if we look to space and we look to our contacts that come from other worlds and the realism of what they exist and what they try to teach us, it gives us hope, and it also should give us momentum to both improve our own selves and hopefully a little bit of what's around us. So we have a great deal of work to do. We have a very worthwhile mission, and I suggest that every one of us take a piece of that and make it their own.
And I have a favor to ask. If you can remember at your next contact, tell them I said hello.
Okay. Funny, the last interviewer a couple of weeks ago, we were on the air for 4 hours, said the same thing. And
really?
I'll say the same thing back. I do not have anything to do with these meetings. It's some they pick the place and when and where and if. And like I said, it has nothing to do with me. I am certainly no special than any more special than anyone else. My introduction and my continued activity is a result of both George Adamski and my parents' work with him, and whom I was privileged as a child to know as well. And so I can only say, in my own mind, I may be the fortunate recipient of the downstream residual of that, or a domino effect. But trust me, I'm just like the rest of you, who would like to earn my one-way ticket off this world.
Okay, Glenn. Have a great evening, sir. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Mark. Well, look forward to doing it again.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.